Good morning, and welcome to the Brookings Institution. I'm delighted to see so many people out there for an event that is both very important and long overdue. This is an event brought to you by a combination of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, of which I am the director, the Century Foundation, and the National Security Network. And we here at Brookings are delighted to be partnering with those two fine organizations to bring you an event which, as I've already said, I feel has been long overdue. Soon after Iran's disputed June 12, 2009 election, I found myself on a number of occasions in Europe and in the Middle East talking with a variety of friends from Iran, people who in those circumstances found it possible to actually speak somewhat freely about what was going on there. And in every one of those conversations, I would say to those people, what is it that the United States can and should do to help the Green Movement, to demonstrate our solidarity with them, but to do so in a way that would actually help them rather than hurting them, that would not trigger Iranian nationalism and fears about foreign subversion and interference in their internal affairs, but that could actually be somewhat helpful to the opposition? And what I typically heard from every single one of those people I spoke to was, you need to talk more about Iranian human rights abuses. That is the one thing that would actually be helpful to us and not hurtful to us. And so it is for that reason that we, along with the National Security Network and the Century Foundation, bring you this event. We have a superb panel, and I will give you brief introductions in just a moment. Perhaps I think the most important thing to understand is that this is a topic which is very much a work in progress. What we have seen in Iran leads us all to have great concern for the people of Iran, for the future of that political system. But at the moment, I think that we're all still struggling to understand fully what is going on there and what can be done about it. And for that reason, I'm delighted to have the four people sitting with me on this panel. We'll begin today with Genève Abdo. I think Genève is well known to many people in this room. She is the director of the Iran program at the Century Foundation and the editor and creator of InsideIran.org. She is also the lead author of a new report on Iranian human rights, which she will be presenting for us today in just a few moments. Genève was, of course, a liaison for the United Nations Alliance of Civilizations. She served for many years as a foreign correspondent for The Guardian and also for The Economist. She is author of a number of superb works, including Answering Only to God, Faith and Freedom in 21st Century Iran. And her newest book is Mecca and Main Street, Muslim Life in America After 9/11. After Genève, we will hear from Mujtaba Vahedi. We are absolutely thrilled to have Mr. Vahedi with us today. Again, this is a name that I think is certainly known to many of you, even if very few in this room have had the pleasure of actually meeting him in person. Mujtaba Vahedi has been one of the closest political advisors to Mehdi Karoubi, the leader of the Iranian Green Movement. He served first as a senior executive in Iran's Ministry of the Treasury. He has been the editor-in-chief of Aftab Yazd, a reformist newspaper in Iran, and in 2005 was Karoubi's chief advisor when he first ran for president, and of course in 2009, during Karoubi's long and very eventful run for the presidency against President Ahmadinejad, Mujtaba Vahedi was standing by Mehdi Karoubi's side the entire time as his chief political advisor. He has unfortunately been forced to flee his native Iran under fear that the government would take action against him. And so for that reason, it is particularly compelling that he be here today to tell us a little bit about the human rights situation in Iran and the role that the international community can play therein. Following Mr. Vahedi, we will hear from Herr Markus Lönig. Markus Lönig is the federal government commissioner for human rights policy and humanitarian aid at the Federal Foreign Office in Berlin. Herr Lönig has also had a long and distinguished career, including membership in the German Bundestag. He has been the chairman of the Parliamentary Friendship Group for Relations with Belgium and Luxembourg. He was the president of the German Group of the Liberal International and ultimately served as the president of the Liberal Party in the state of Berlin. We're thrilled to have him here to give us a European and international perspective on this issue. And finally, we will hear from Philo Dibble, an old friend and colleague of mine. Philo was dragged back into government recently to serve as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs for Iran. Again, for those of you who have been in Washington for any period of time, I am sure that Philo's name and face are familiar ones to you. He has served in any number of capacities during his long service in the Foreign Service. He was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of International Organization Affairs. He has been the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in Near Eastern Affairs. He was our Deputy Chief of Mission in Damascus and has served in a whole variety of overseas posts, mostly in the Middle East. Philo is also, I can tell you, one of the most effective, one of the most insightful, and one of the clearest-eyed thinkers that you will find in the U.S. bureaucracy. And I think that that says a tremendous amount these days for him and for the department in bringing him back when they realized that they needed someone to actually deal with Iran and actually figure out where it is that we go, given all the problems that we've had with them over the past few years. So with that, I will turn things over to Genevieve to get us started and to present the report and her findings.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this important discussion, and I'm particularly grateful to Ken for organizing this event and to the Brookings staff. As we all know, Ken is a renowned expert on Iran, and I'm grateful for his support on this issue and for allowing us this wonderful platform in which to discuss human rights in Iran. I thought I would give you a brief summary of the reports which are being distributed outside, placing human rights violations in Iran on top of the foreign policy agenda. The report is written by myself and also my colleague who's present here, Sebastian Grafe from the Heinrich Böll Foundation here in Washington. We decided, as Ken pointed out, to try to highlight this issue, which is receiving a lot of attention in Europe, but much less so in the United States. And so in July in Brussels, the Heinrich Böll Foundation helped us organize a meeting that's part of an ongoing series of conferences that I hold as part of the program I'm directing along with the National Security Network that basically brings together Iranian academics, people who are involved in the opposition movement, others who are living outside but also helping the movement inside. And we pair them with European and American policymakers to talk about some of the sensitive issues that people aren't really talking about publicly. And so our last meeting in Brussels, that meeting was focused on human rights. And it is some of our discussions that we had in Brussels that prompted Sebastian and I to write this report. The report is also based upon research that both of us conducted in Washington, in Europe, and in Turkey. Unfortunately, we were not able to go to Iran for the report, but nonetheless, I think that it's quite informative about the situation in Iran. As we all know, the state of human rights in Iran has deteriorated even further since the 2009 disputed election that brought President Ahmadinejad to power. During the heated months that followed the election, the authorities imprisoned thousands of high-profile activists and in some cases subjected them to severe torture. Later, they moved on to minor figures who had participated in a few demonstrations but were virtually unknown. And now, a year and a half later, we see that the regime is targeting very, very minor civil society actors who have participated in maybe one or two demonstrations, and they're particularly focused on the universities. This is not really received that much coverage in the United States, but the regime is now trying to cleanse the universities of anyone involved in civil disobedience to the point of even destroying their academic records. And we know personally, just from our work on the project, that in our contact with young students, that many of them now have been expelled and they have virtually no future, because they cannot prove that they ever attended university. Mr. Vahedi will speak in a few minutes more specifically about the regime's strategy. So in addition to this kind of repression, we've also seen the pace of executions, not only for alleged politically related crimes, but for adultery and social behavior that has been deemed un-Islamic. These people are also being targeted. Now more than ever, the segment of the Iranian population seeking positive change feels depleted and disillusioned. We've had many statements coming from Iran, even from people such as Faiza Hashemi, the daughter of the former president, talking about just how depressed and disillusioned the population has become. A sizable percentage of young Iranians have given up hope and reform may occur anytime soon. Others who have the resources to do so have been fleeing to Turkey with the hope of eventually being settled in the EU or the United States. So one of the central messages that has come out of our Brussels meetings is that the Iranians want Western governments to draw attention to Iran's human rights violations and pressure Iran's regime. There is a tendency to believe here in the West that defending the rights of Iranian civil society will taint the opposition, as Ken mentioned. And while that may have been true and sort of the feeling among a lot of civil society actors right after the June 2009 election, it is less so true today. As one of our Iranian participants mentioned in Brussels, he said, quote, "The international community must take a clear stance against the government with its regard to the treatment of the civil rights movement in Iran. Second, in order to create a democratic society, we must build civil society. Third, we must address the situation that all human rights organizations in Iran are banned. And fourth, we must address the lack of the free flow of information." Now, the person who made this comment was an Iranian diplomat who defected in January of this year and is now living in exile in Oslo. It was also agreed by the Iranian participants in Brussels that the United States and Europe should arrive at a coordinated effort to highlight violations in order to support civil society. So there's a feeling among a lot of Iranians that even when there's a willingness by governments to address this issue, that there is no coordinated effort. And therefore, it's very easy for the Iranian regime to dismiss the complaints from Western governments on this issue. There's also a feeling that, as Ken pointed out, that to highlight human rights is to taint the opposition movement. And the point that a lot of the Iranians made in our meeting was that this is going to happen anyway. The regime has already made, as a part of its strategy, the claim that Western governments are behind regime change in Iran. And so this argument is being made by the authorities whether or not Western governments highlight human rights. Two of our Iranian participants in Brussels also noted that the regime cares when it is criticized for its human rights violations, and therefore this could serve as a pressure point for Western governments. The other point that came out of our meeting and that we have highlighted in our report is the situation of Iranian refugees fleeing Iran to Turkey with the hope that they will be resettled in the United States or Europe. Again, there has not been that much attention focused on the refugee problem, particularly if you view this in light of the attention that was drawn to Iraqi refugees. So we want to make sure that there is attention placed on this issue. At the end of 2009, there were 4,200 Iranians in need of protection that had been registered with the UNHCR in Turkey. The situation for them in Turkey is difficult. According to Turkish laws, which date to the 1940s, refugees can only be granted status as asylum seekers, which means that they're not eligible for financial aid, they don't have jobs, and they're assigned to live in towns primarily in Anatolia, which creates a lot of hardships for them. In order to actually be granted political asylum, the process takes approximately 2 years, and that's considered fairly fast. So you have a situation where Iranian refugees are sort of in Turkey without any means of livelihood, and they're waiting to sort of be processed through the UNHCR system. Therefore, another recommendation that stems from our report was to support the rights and needs of Iranian refugees. The Iranian participants in Brussels called upon the United States, the European Union, and Turkey to increase the numbers of persons granted refugee resettlement status and also increase funding for NGOs both in Turkey and in Europe that are trying to help with the refugee crisis. We have a few charts in our report that will show you exactly the numbers and where people are being resettled. In conclusion, I'd just like to point out that our report states that in addition to improving the human rights situation for Iranians for humanitarian reasons, we also need to highlight this issue in order to try to affect public opinion inside Iran. And I think that this is another point that has somewhat gone unnoticed, that the Iranian society and the people particularly who have been affected by the human rights violations, this is a point in which people, even the staunch supporters of the regime, really care about. And according to scholarly research we know that's happening inside Iran now, this is a subject that can turn public opinion in Iran against the regime. So that's the other reason to try to highlight this issue on the outside with the hope that we can affect public opinion inside. So I'll leave it with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Genevieve. First, for those people sitting in the back, there are actually a number of seats up here at front. If you'd like to come down, I can see 10 or 11 seats right up here in front. Please do feel free to come down. We'd be delighted to actually have you sit rather than having to stand. I know it's a lovely wall back there, but if you'd like to sit, I promise you the seats are actually quite comfortable. I'd like to turn things over now to Mushtaba Vahidi, and I should let everyone know that Mr. Vahidi will be speaking through a translator, so please be patient with us and allow the translator to actually translate everything that Mr. Vahidi has to say. Mushtaba, please.
Good morning, everybody. I apologize all of you because my English is not good enough to talk in English. I asked my friend Jensen to translate. I hope the next time I see you, all of you can speak in Farsi, and there is no need to translator. من بحث رو با از یک فاز دیگه شروع میکنم که فکر میکنم در بحث هایی که تا به حال مطرح شده بهش توجه نشده.
I will begin my speaking with some topics that I believe have not been attended to up till now.
این موضوع بحث استراتژی حاکمیت ایران در موضوع حقوق بشر هست.
And this topic is the strategy of the Iranian government with regards to human rights.
به نظر من رفتار حاکمیت ایران و استراتژی حاکمیت ایران در مورد حقوق بشر قبل از انتخابات سال 2009 و بعد از اون به طور کلی تفاوت کرده.
It is my opinion that the strategy of the government with regards to human rights has changed from what its strategy was before the elections of 2009 and after the elections of 2009.
ما همیشه در سالهای گذشته بحث نقض حقوق بشر در ایران رو داشتیم، اما تلاش حاکمیت این بوده که تکذیب بکنه و یا مخفی کاری بکنه یا بپوشونه موارد نقض حقوق بشر رو.
We have always had issues regarding human rights in Iran, and it has always been the effort of the government to either cover up or outright reject the notion of human rights violations in Iran.
اما بعد از انتخابات سال 2009 به دلیلی که خواهم گفت، خود حاکمیت اصرار داره موارد نقض حقوق بشر رو به صورت گسترده افشا بکنه.
But after the elections, for reasons I will tell you, the government itself insists that its human rights violations be given coverage.
دلیل این استراتژی جدید اینه که حاکمیت به این نتیجه رسید اگر سرکوب شدید انجام نده و اگر اجازه بده فعالان حقوق بشر در ایران فعال باشن، تداوم تظاهرات خیابانی و تداوم اعتراضات میتونه حتی به سقوط خیلی سریع حاکمیت منجر بشه.
And the reason is that the government reached the conclusion that if there is no strict oppression of the protests and violations of human rights are not shown to the people, then these protests will continue until the overthrow of the government.
نکته دیگه هم این هستش که به خاطر انعکاس وسیع قتل بعضی از تظاهر کننده ها از جمله خانم ندا آقا سلطان و ضرب و شتم تظاهر کننده ها در خیابون ها، حکومت ایران به این نتیجه رسیده که آبرویی در دنیا نداره که بخواد با دفاع از رفتار حقوق بشری خودش اون آبرو رو حفظ بکنه.
Also after the pictures of protesters being killed were distributed around the world, including Nedo Sultan, and people saw the way it was the protesters were being treated, the Iranian government reached the conclusion that there is no credibility remaining for it to lose.
به همین جهت به این نتیجه رسیده که بهترین راه براش اینه که با علنی کردن سرکوب و خشونت مردم رو بترسونه و کشور رو از طریق ارعاب کامل فعلا کنترل بکنه.
Therefore the conclusion was by revealing the violence and the oppression the government chose to use fear as a means in order to put pressure on the protesters and to silence the protests.
اولین گام در این استراتژی جدید در اوائل سپتامبر 2009 یعنی در حدود 14 ماه پیش برداشته شد که من این رو توضیح میدم الان.
The first step was taken in this regard from in the beginning of September 2009 which I will explain to you.
روز ششم سپتامبر سال 2009 تلویزیون دولتی ایران یک گزارشی از زندان کهریزک پخش کرد.
On September 6, 2009, the Iranian television broadcasted a report of Kahrizak prison.
این گزارش رو من اون موقع سردبیر روزنامه آفتاب یزد بودم در روزنامه منعکس کردیم. حالا یه مقدار توضیح میدم گزارشی که اتفاقا توسط همسر خود من که اینجا هست تهیه شد و موضوع رو کاملا باز کردم.
The report was reflected in newspapers, including my newspaper. I was the editor of Aftab-e Yazd at the time. We put the report on our first page, and the report was put together by my wife.
در اینجا رئیس بازرسی پلیس ایران یک گزارشی در تلویزیون رسمی ایران داد از اتفاقاتی که در کهریزک افتاده.
The chief inspector of Iranian police gave a report regarding the events that occurred in Kahrizak prison.
فکر میکنم همه شما یا اکثر شما موضوع کهریزک رو شنیدید اما ابعادی از کهریزک که در این گزارش اومده شاید به گوش خیلی از افراد نرسیده باشه.
I'm pretty sure that some of you or all of you have heard the name of Kahrizak, but the dimensions that have been mentioned in this report might not have reached your attention.
در اینجا اشاره شده به شکنجه هایی که در زندان انجام شده، محرومیت های غذایی و دارویی و سختگیری هایی که نسبت به زندانی ها شده.
In this report, the tortures are mentioned and also the deprivation of medical needs and food that the prisoners had to go through.
اما شاید عجیب ترین نکته نمیدونم دوستانی که اینجا هستن شنیدن یا نه، موضوعیه که من الان میخوام بهش اشاره بکنم.
But the most important is an issue that I will mention right now.
رئیس بازرسی نیروی انتظامی در این گزارشش که از تلویزیون ایران دو بار کاملا پخش شد گفت ما 145 نفر از جوانهای بازداشتی رو در یک اتاق 70 متر مربعی بازداشت کرده بودیم به مدت 3 روز.
The chief inspector of Tehran police said in the report, which was also broadcasted on television two times, that they were holding 145 prisoners in a room of 70 square meters for 3 days.
من تأکید میکنم 145 نفر در 70 متر مربع.
I would like to mention it again, 145 people in 70 square meters.
در یعنی هر نفر نیم متر مربع برای 3 روز.
That means each person had half a square meter which he was living in for 3 days.
روز دوم از این 3 روز طبق گفته همین آقای رئیس بازرسی 25 نفر از اراذل اوباش خطرناک رو بین این 145 نفر اضافه کردن یعنی شد 170 نفر در 70 متر مربع که 25 نفرشون اراذل اوباش خطرناک بودن.
On the second day, based upon the report, they also added 25 notorious criminals who were known for violent actions and hooliganism to these prisoners. So as of day two, it was 170 prisoners in 70 square meters.
من همون روز در ادیتوریال روزنامه سرمقاله روزنامه اشاره کردم که شاید ادعای آقای کروبی که گفته در زندان تجاوز شده مرتبط با همین افراد باشه چون این اراذل اوباش خطرناک یکی از اتهامات رایجشون تجاوز و مسائل غیر اخلاقی در ایران هست.
At the time my newspaper mentioned that maybe some of the claims of rape that were mentioned by Mr. Kadubi were committed by these criminals which were put in the same area that the other prisoners were because the crimes that many of these prisoners had committed was rape.
این اولین گام بود. در اون زمان بعضی افراد ادعا داشتن که حکومت جمهوری اسلامی تصمیم گرفته با جنایت کهریزک برخورد بکنه و افشای این گزارش گام اول این برخورد هست.
This was the beginning and this was the first step of its of the government's plan and the government claimed at the time that they will deal efficiently with those who committed crimes at Kahrizak.
اما امروز با گذشت 16 ماه از موضوع کهریزک و حدود 13 ماه از این گزارشی که من اشاره کردم، متهم اصلی کهریزک معاون آقای احمدی نژاد در ایران.
But now that 16 months have passed since the crime itself and 13 months since the reports have came out, the main person who was behind these crimes is believed to be Mr. Ahmadinejad himself in Iran.
این متهم آقای مرتضوی هست که در زمان جنایت کهریزک دادستان تهران بوده و الان همه مقامات ایران قبول دارن متهم اصلی کهریزک آقای مرتضوی هست.
I would like to correct my previous statement. The main the person who is being held for these crimes is Mr. Mortazavi, which is an individual very close to Ahmadinejad.
معاون آقای احمدی نژاد هست.
He is actually now the deputy of Mr. Ahmadinejad.
این حکم صادر شده و ایشون رسما در تلویزیون ایران میاد به عنوان نماینده رئیس جمهور، به عنوان معاون رئیس جمهور مصاحبه میکنه و گزارش به مردم میده.
This person comes onto television as the deputy of the president, as representative of the president, and states reports his reports to the people.
این موضوع نشون میده که افشای کهریزک نه از باب حق طلبی یا احقاق حق افرادی بوده که اونجا مورد ظلم قرار گرفتن، بلکه برای ارعاب مردم بوده که به خانواده ها بگن اگر فرزندانتون در تظاهرات دستگیر بشن سرنوشتشون تجاوز و شکنجه در کهریزک است.
This shows that the intention of the government for revealing the crimes at Kahrizak was not bringing those who were behind the crimes to justice, but to bring fear into the equation and to make people be afraid and to get the message across that if your children participate in protests, this will be their fate at Kahrizak prison.
باز من تکرار میکنم، با گذشت 16 ماه از موضوع کهریزک هنوز یک نفر به صورت رسمی در موضوع کهریزک محکوم نشده که بر آقای مرتضوی که متهم اصلی کهریزک تازه مقام دولتی هم داره، مقام خیلی بلند مرتبه دولتی داره.
I would like to repeat that after 16 months not one person has been prosecuted or held accountable for the crimes that were committed at Kahrizak. And the main person who was behind these crimes, Mr. Mortazavi himself, has actually been rewarded for these crimes and he is now the deputy president.
اما همونطوری که گفتم موضوع کهریزک و افشای اون اولین گام استراتژی وحشت آفرینی و ارعاب توسط دولت جمهوری اسلامی بود.
But as I mentioned, Kahrizak was the first step of using fear as a means by the Iranian government.
گام بعد اعدام دو نفر از متهمان دستگیر شده بعد از انتخابات بود که حتما اسمشون شنید، آرش رحمانی و آقای علی زمانی.
The second stage was the execution of two of those held allegedly for protests after the elections, Mr. Zamani and
آرش رحمانی.
And Mr. آرش رحمانی.
بعد از اعدام اینها آقای جنتی که یکی از قدرتمندترین مقامات ایران هست در نماز جمعه اومد ضمن که تشکر کرد از رئیس قوه قضاییه فقط گله کرد که چرا کم اعدام کردید.
After that Mr. Jannati himself, which is a high level official in Iran, came to the Friday prayers, attended Friday prayers, and in those Friday prayers his only objection was why did you not execute more people.
و این خیلی علنی بود، یعنی بارها هم از تلویزیون ایران این سخنرانی آقای جنتی پخش شد.
This was very public and his statements were broadcasted by the television many times.
این الان من پرینت شده همین خبر آقای جنتی رو هم دارم که خبرگزاری رسمی ایسنا این رو منتشر کرده، همین عبارت هم درش هست که خیلی ممنون که دو نفر رو اعدام کردید ولی باز هم اعدام بکنید.
In my hand is the report by an official state news agency, the Iranian Student News Agency, where these statements have been published. And it has been published that thank you for executing and why didn't you execute more?
بعد از اون به صورت مرتب برنامه‌های دولت و سیاست‌گذاری دولت بر اساس همین سیاست ارعاب و محدودسازی بوده در کشور.
After that, for it has been persistently the policy of the government to use fear, propagate fear as a means to put pressure on the population.
من چند نمونه میگم از کارهایی که دولت انجام داده برای اینکه هم سیاست ارعابش رو ادامه بده و هم محدودسازی بکنه. یکی از موارد عمده نقض حقوق بشر که سانسور و جلوگیری از انتشار اخبار هست. من چند نمونه خدمتتون عرض میکنم.
I will give you several examples of where this fear was used as a means by the government, also censorship and violation of human rights.
در طول یک سال گذشته سایت‌های خبری هر تمام مراجع تقلیدی که منتقد دولت بودن در کشور سانسور فیلتر شده.
During the previous year, all of the ranking clerics who were criticizing the government and objected to the actions of the government, all of their websites have been filtered.
فراکسیون اقلیت مجلس شورای اسلامی که 60 نماینده داره یک دونه وبسایت اطلاع رسانی داره، اون رو یک سال فیلتر کردن.
The minority fraction of the parliament, the reformist minority, they have a website which has been filtered for one year.
در عرصه دانشگاه ها علاوه بر دستگیری دانشجویان و برخورد با بعض از اساتید، هر استادی که به نحوی منتقد دولت بوده در شورای بازنشستگی که آخرین نمونش آقای محمد خوش‌چهره بوده که در مورد ایشون توضیح میدم ایشون کی هست.
And in the academia, Mr. Mohammad Khoshchehre, I will explain to you who he is.
خیلی از اساتید رو بازنشسته کردن به خصوص آقای خوش‌چهره.
They have been including him, many other professors have been forced to resign.
آقای خوش‌چهره رئیس بخش اقتصادی کمپین آقای احمدی نژاد در دور اول انتخابات بود.
Mr. خوش‌چهره was the head of Ahmadi Nejad's economic campaign during his first elections.
اما بعد از یک سال اومد مصاحبه کرد و گفت احمدی نژاد به هیچ مبنای علمی پایبند نیست، به همین جهت من با ایشون همکاری نمی‌کنم.
After a year he came out and publicly stated that Mr. Ahmadi Nejad does not stand by any academic or any scientific means of economy of evaluating the economy and I will not work with him.
گمان هم نکنید اگر اساتید رو بازنشسته میکنن مثلا خجالت میکشن یا رو درواسی دارن. وزیر علوم اخیراً یک مصاحبه کرد و گفت ما دانشگاه ها رو بر سر اساتید سکولار تخریب خواهیم کرد.
And don't think that when they force these professors to resign, they're ashamed of it. Only recently, the Minister of Science stated that we will bring down the walls of the universities upon secular professors.
در حالی که البته آقای خوش‌چهره استاد سکولار هم نبود، یک استاد کاملا تا چند وقت پیش کاملا حزب اللهی بود، فقط چون منتقد احمدی نژاد هست به زور بازنشستش کردن.
And this is why Mr. خوش‌چهره was not even a secular professor. Up until recently he was known as a religious and a حزب اللهی professor, but still because he was critical of احمدی نژاد he was forced to resign.
من نمونه زیاده، اما برای اینکه فکر نکنید این سانسور یا فیلتر کردن فقط شامل حال منتقدین رسمی دولت میشه، یه خبر همینجا دارم. دادستان تهران یک مصاحبه خیلی جالبی کرده، این رو هم بعدیست بشنوید.
I also have another example here for you to understand that these actions are not only limited to officials and professors. The Tehran province prosecutor has a statement over here which I would like to read for you.
ایشون یه مصاحبه‌ای در یک ماه پیش کرده و گفته مسئولان دولتی به روزنامه‌ها فشار میارن که حرفای من رو چاپ نکنن.
He stated last month that the government newspapers are being forced to not publish my statements.
ببینید دادستان تهران گله میکنه که دولت مانع انتشار حرفاش در داخل کشور میشه.
You should pay attention. This is the Tehran prosecutor who is objecting that the government is preventing newspapers from publishing his statements.
چند وقت پیش در سایت‌های خبری منتشر شد وزارت ارشاد یک دستورالعمل خیلی رسمی صادر کرده و اعلام کرده که روزنامه‌ها حق ندارن کوچکترین خبری در مورد موسوی، کروبی و خاتمی بنویسن. یعنی محدودسازی‌ها، من اینا رو دارم میگم برای اینکه مشخص یه عرصه‌های مختلف رو شامل بشه و می‌خوام نتیجه‌گیری کنم.
A while ago, it was also published that newspapers have been ordered to not publish any statements or any articles on Musavi, on Karubi, or Khatami.
همه اینها نشون میده که دولت بناش برای اینکه نشون بده در سطوح مختلف هر کس که خیلی علنی هم میخوان رو بگن در سطوح مختلف هر کس منتقد دولت باشه در داخل ایران اجازه فعالیت نداره.
They are trying to publicly get the message across to become public commonly known that whoever is critical of the government or has objectives to the government has no right to have his or her statements be published.
بر اساس همین استراتژی می‌بینید محکومیت‌های خیلی سنگین صادر کردن و جالب هم هست که بدونید بیشتر این محکومیت‌ها شامل حال دانشجوها و فعالان مطبوعاتی و سیاسی میشه.
This is why they are issuing very heavy statements and a lot of these heavy verdicts for students and also دانشجوها
فعالان سیاسی و مطبوعاتی
and for students, for journalists and for political activists.
من 4 تا حکمی که اخیراً صادر شده نمونهش به شما میگم برای اینکه بدونید آقای حسین درخشان که فقط وبلاگ نویس بوده خارج از کشورم بوده نه جاسوسی میتونست بکنه چی 19 و نیم سال زندان.
I will give you a few examples. Mr. Hossein Derakhshan, who was only a weblog writer, he was a blogger. He has been sentenced to 19 and a half years in prison.
آقای حمزه کرمی مدیر یک سایت خبری در داخل کشور بوده به نام جمهوریت به 11 سال زندان محکوم شده.
Mr. Hamza Karami was heading a website in Iran called Jumhuriyat and he has been sentenced to 11 years in prison.
مجید توکلی دانشجو بود فقط به خاطر یک سخنرانی که در دانشگاه امیرکبیر کرد به 8 سال و نیم زندان محکوم شده.
مجید توکلی a student has been sentenced to 8 and a half years in prison for a speech, only a speech that he had in the university.
و نهایتاً اینکه اونهایی هم که زندانی میشن با سختگیری‌های خیلی شدیدی مواجهن، مثلا خانم هنگامه شهیدی، آقای مسعود باستانی به گواهی پزشکان نیاز به مرخصی دارن ولی وثیقه هایی براشون صادر میکنن برای آزادی که امکان تودیعش نیست و نمیتونن مثلا برای خانم شهیدی $600,000 وثیقه صادر کنن کردن که بره برای مرخصی استعلاجی برای درمان بیماریش.
Others who are also in prison are in a very bad situation. They are under constant pressure. The doctors have ordered that Mrs. Hengame Shahidi and
مسعود باستانی
and Mr. Masood Bastani be seen by the doctor and to be released from prison for treatment, but the bail money that they put for them is so high, for example $600,000 bail fees, that in action these people are not allowed to leave prison because they're unable to raise the bail money.
طبق چیزی که من 2 دقیقه بیشتر وقت ندارم من جمع‌بندی بکنم.
I only have 2 minutes based upon what my watch tells me, so I will put this all together.
به نظر من استراتژی که دولت ایران داره از یک جهت موفق شده.
I believe that the strategy of Iranian government to an extent has been successful.
بر اساس این استراتژی سرکوب شدید باعث شده که تظاهرات خیابانی و نمود مخالفت‌ها یه مقدار کم رنگ بشه در حالی که به نظر من مخالفت خیلی جدی در داخل کشور وجود داره.
Based upon the strategy, the street protests and the actual type of protests and objections that is visible to us has gone down to a large extent. Although there is objection towards the government actions, and there is a large amount of objection towards what they do.
نتیجه این که دولت‌های خارجی متأسفانه از جمله دولت‌های غربی که دلشون می‌خواد با دولت ایران به خاطر امتیازدهی‌هاش معامله بکنن بهانه پیدا کردن و میگن هیچ آلترناتیوی برای دولت ایران وجود نداره.
That's why other governments, non-Iranian governments, are using this as a reason to validate their argument that there are no other options remaining to deal with Iran.
در واقع هیچ آلترناتیوی برای دولت ایران وجود نداره و ما ناچاریم با دولت ایران معامله بکنیم.
I'm sorry, I'll correct that. There are no alternatives remaining for the Iranian government. And we have to, therefore, sit at the negotiation table with them. It's a good time to do so.
در حالی که من تأکید کردم به هیچ وجه اینطور نیست. مخالفت در داخل ایران خیلی گسترده است. نمونهش همین که به محض این که احتمال حضور سران جنبش سبز در تظاهرات پیش میاد، بلافاصله محدودیت ایجاد میکنند که نمونه آخرش هم 5 روز محاصره منزل آقای کروبی در آستانه روز قدس بود، چون میدونستن ایشون اگر بیاد بیرون جمعیت زیادیشون رو همراهی خواهد کرد.
But that's not the case. Whenever even there is mention of the leaders of the Green Movement coming out onto the streets, they have severe security measures taken. Just as recently, there was a possibility that Mr. Kadobi was to attend one of the public demonstrations, and his house was put under siege, and he was in fact imprisoned in his house under house arrest for 5 days.
امیدوارم اگر نکاتی باشه من میتونم در بخش پرسش و پاسخ جواب بدم. من چون مقید هستم زمان رعایت کنم با عزتتون حرفو تموم کنم همینجا.
I hope if there's anything remaining we can go through it in Q&A, and because of the time I think I will have to stop at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Vahedi. Herr Lening, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much and good morning to everybody. The human rights situation in Iran has been very bad up to the elections in last year already. And as we have heard now, but that's the assessment the German government shares, it has dramatically worsened over the last years. We have seen a crackdown on any kind of opposition, on any kind of dissident voice, on people speaking out, on people writing, on people standing up for their rights, in an unprecedented way by the government of President Ahmadinejad over the last bit more than a year since the election. The German government is extremely concerned about what is happening there, and we share the what has been said, that what we need to do is speak out publicly, speak out clearly on the situation, and try to put pressure on the Iranian government, because that is one thing that we believe seems to work. It seems, as funny as it may sound, that public exposure is not what the Iranian government likes. If they are being confronted in public, be it in the framework of the UN, in the Human Rights Council, or in the Third Committee in New York, or via newspapers, with demonstrations on the streets of our cities, it is not what the Iranian government likes. Whenever I make a public statement to the German press, I get a very long letter from the Iranian ambassador to Germany explaining why I am wrong. So they do take notice of what we are saying, and I know that for example, whenever we have bilateral meetings with Iranians, we do address the human rights issues at all levels. It is starting with the foreign minister. If he meets his Iranian counterpart, he's addressing that very, very clearly. We had people from the German parliament traveling to Iran twice in the last month, and they have been very outspoken on this situation. And we see, you hear the German chancellor being very clear, you hear the German foreign minister being very clear in public. The question is, some of these pressures that we make, some of them we don't make in public. Sometimes we try to use other channels. It seems to us that this pressure does make a difference. It may be a small difference sometimes. It may be frustrating sometimes that in certain cases that we don't achieve making a difference. But all in all, we believe that is the main instrument we have at the moment, is to put public pressure on the Iranian government. What we have also done, what we are busy doing, is bringing refugees from Iran to Germany. You have talked about the Iranian refugees that are in Turkey now, in eastern Turkey. Germany has invited 50 human rights defenders that have fled Iran in the course of the last year, and that are now mainly in eastern Turkey. We have invited 50 of these human rights defenders to come to Germany, to live in Germany, and to work in Germany, and to continue their work in Germany, which is a difficult process to get them from Turkey to Germany, but we have more of half of them are meanwhile in Germany, have arrived in Germany, and I will be personally visiting some of the people that are still in Turkey in the next week to see how they are doing and how we could speed up that process. That is something I'm not very happy about, that this takes so long, but at least we do accept people, we do invite people, and I think it's important that the West as a whole and many countries in the West clearly send this signal that we invite people to come and live safely and continue their human rights work from our countries. I believe one thing we have to, we should also point out to the Iranians again and again, is that this government is actually not complying to the Iranian laws. I mean, some of the things that that are being done now by the police, that are the crackdowns that are being done, are against Iranian laws. Some of the things that we see happening in Iran are against what Iran has committed to on the international level. And I think it is important to always remind the Iranian government of Iranian laws, of the Iranian constitution, but also of the international commitments they have made, and to tell them very clearly that we expect them to comply with the commitments they have made and to comply with the Iranian laws. As funny as it may sound, but I believe that we should also do that and say there is an Iranian constitution, and at least we expect you to be in line with the Iranian constitution and respect the Iranian constitution. I think apart from that, what we also need to do is go on working at the UN level. We strongly support the new country resolution on the human rights situation in Iran, that's going to be in the General Assembly. I believe this needs to be done again and again and again. And I think it is also very important to not to mingle the nuclear issue and the human rights issue. I think the human rights issue needs to be dealt with separate from the nuclear issue. We need to address the human rights situation again and again. We need to help the people that are fleeing Iran. We need to go public. And we need as much as we can, and that is obviously very, very difficult, try to support the people that are fighting for, standing up for their rights in Iran. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Erlang. Philo, wrap things up for us.
Thanks. I think it's appropriate then to sort of finish up, and I'll try and be as brief as I can to leave as much time as possible for questions, with what the United States is trying to do in this context. Let me just mention, first of all, our most recent action. You will note that basically a month ago today, the President signed an executive order authorizing the Departments of State and Treasury to impose sanctions on 8 Iranian government officials tied to serious human rights abuses against the people of Iran. I want to note that one of them is Mr. Mortazavi that was mentioned by our friend Vahidi. These actions not only obviously have the support of the President, his message was unmistakable, but also the Secretary of State, who jointly designated these individuals with Secretary of the Treasury. This comes in the context of policy actions of longstanding and which we have taken, I think, continuously over the years. The most obvious being high-level statements that spotlight Iran's most egregious human rights abuses. The work we have done in the Human Rights Council and in the Third Committee of the General Assembly, as our colleague mentioned. The Country Report on Human Rights Practices in Iran, which we do annually, as well as the annual International Religious Freedom Report. And our efforts, along with other countries, pressing them, among other things, to speak out as loudly as possible to condemn the human rights situation. Finally, I'd like to mention our support for refugees seeking to flee Iran, which we have provided through the UN Committee on Refugees, and as Geneve's report makes clear, our leading role in admitting asylees from Iran. A second feature that I think is worth pointing out is our Iran Democracy Program, which is funded in fiscal year 2010 at a level of $40 million by the Congress. This is, I think, the 6th such appropriation. The point of this program is to find ways to allow civil society to acquire the tools necessary to hold the government in Iran accountable for its actions. This is a difficult program to administer because obviously it's difficult to do this kind of thing inside Iran, and our efforts have therefore been confined to some extent to Iranians who are outside the country. I will not go into a lot of detail on this because our first concern, of course, is to protect those who participate in these programs. So I'm not going to give you a lot of information about it. I just want you to know that it's there, and I want you to know what the purpose of it is up front. Finally, again, as our colleague Mr. Vahedi mentioned, is the question of the use of the Internet and other means of communication, both from the outside into Iran and the and means of communication among Iranians inside Iran. Internet freedom is a priority of the Secretary of State. It's a global issue. It doesn't involve just Iran, but Iran is a very important piece of it. We are currently working on a global strategy into which Iran will fit. I would like to give you more detail, but again, this is, first of all, a highly technical question. It's a question with a great deal of technical ambiguity, since what is a useful tool for a dissident is also a useful tool for repressing a dissident. However, what we have done so far is to license free software to be provided to users inside Iran so that they can have a better chance, let's put it that way, of talking to each other and talking to the outside world. Finally, I'd like to echo Mr. Lerning's comment that all of this becomes much more effective if we can do this together with other governments and with NGOs and with others who are concerned about developments inside Iran. Obviously, what happens in Iran is ultimately a matter for the Iranian people to do and to deal with. We, however, have an obligation, as the President has said repeatedly, to speak out, to highlight abuses, and to help where we can. I'd like to stop there and give time for questions.
Thank you, Philo. I really appreciate being able to have you on this panel and hear from you on that. I'd like to start the question because I think that there was an issue that Mr. Vahedi raised, but I'd love to hear him a little bit more fully on it because I think it's a question that a lot of Americans have that often kind of preoccupies the question whenever it gets raised in the United States regarding Iranian human rights. The question I'd like to put to you, Mr. Vahedi, and Janine, please feel free to echo as well, is the question of why is it that the regime is so sensitive on the issue of human rights? You know, a lot of Americans see this as a regime with complete control over its population that uses as much force as it needs to whenever it needs to, but you very consistently and I think very powerfully made the point that this is an area of great sensitivity for them. And I think it's useful, I think it would be helpful for our audience here to understand why it is such a sensitive issue for them, why they are so nervous about this issue.
فکر میکنم که توضیح من این بود که الان دیگه موضوع حساسی براشون نیست و اونها مهمترین موضوع براشون حفظ حاکمیت به هر قیمتی هست.
I believe I explained that the issue of human rights is not a sensitive issue for them anymore. The most sensitive issue for them is to holding their place as government.
من گمان میکنم اگر یک دولتی نسبت به مسئله حقوق بشر کوچکترین حساسیتی داشته باشه بعضی از کارهایی که من اینجا گفتم رو انجام نمیده.
I believe if a government is even to a very small extent sensitive towards issues of human rights, they would do none of the stuff that I stated to you over here.
ببینید اینجا در آمریکا از آقای احمد نژاد سوال میکنن که چرا جوانها رو تو خیابونها کتک میزنن، چرا میکشن؟ ایشون میگه برای اینکه اینا به پلیس حمله کردن، در حالی که یک نمونه هم نتونستن نشون بدن که مردم به پلیس حمله کرده باشن.
Over here they asked Mr. Ahmadinejad why are people being attacked, why is violence being used against them, and his response is constantly that they attack the police, while in reality they have not been able to produce one bit of evidence or an example of such a thing occurring.
آخرین جمله بگم اگر برای دولتی مسئله حقوق بشر حساس بود سرشناس‌ترین امام جمعهش نمیمد تو نماز جمعه بگه که دستتون درد نکنه دو نفر رو کشید ولی چرا کم کشتید.
I would like to repeat again, if the issue of human rights was important for a government, then it's well known and most popular imam for Friday prayers would not come and say in front of everybody that it's good that you executed people and why you not execute more.
I think that the question we're trying to get to is, yes, there maybe they don't feel threatened by the reaction to the brutality, but I think there's enough evidence for us to conclude that they are sensitive on this issue, particularly to international pressure and also to the kinds of response that has happened inside the country. I mean, if you look. Mr. Vahidi mentioned this earlier. If you look at the criticism that's come from the clerical establishment, I mean, this is really significant. And I think that that there is a problem for the regime now because they're being called, their Islamic credentials are being called into question by the clerical establishment. So the question now out there in Iran is how can the current leadership then sort of claim that they are heading an Islamic state if you consider the human rights violations. And that's why I think it's a particular problem now, because you have people within the clerical establishment calling the regime out on this kind of torture and human rights violations.
Thank you to both of you. That was very helpful. Okay, why don't we open it up? We've got a fair amount of time. Are there any questions out there? We'll start right down here. Do we have microphone? Yeah, if you can just wait for the microphone. And please do remember to ask a question rather than simply making a statement.
Thank you so much for doing the talk and bringing to the attention what needs to be said after the election. One more thing to add to Mr. Vahidi's comments. They appointed a cleric in each school and university to overview all the academic curriculum of students. And recently, 2 days ago, at the Chronicle, New York Chronicle, they eliminated 12 disciplines in schools. So those students have no way to transfer. And my question is if there is a way to communicate to the admission of universities around the world to be a little bit more flexible for Iranian students, make sometimes exceptions. There are brilliant students there, have no way out. They have no way to continue their studies. And if there is a possibility to look into not have them as refugee but as students when they come overseas, keeping a student visa, because when they become refugee and want to continue their studies, it becomes, I'm not sure if this is a question, but if there is a way to have them come here or anywhere else as students.
Thank you. Let's put it in the form of a question. Herr Lenning, Philo, are there things that we can be doing in terms of helping Iranian students who very much would like to study abroad and are fearful of heading back?
I think, obviously, I can't make any promises from this seat, but I think it's an interesting question. I think the repression in the universities and especially the cancellation of whole disciplines is something that we need to consider as we look at refugee admissions policies. And I'm happy to make a note of it and take it back.
Well, obviously, I also can't make a promise from here. But what we do look at is our policies generally for student admission, for student visa, not only for Iran, but also for other countries, because we believe it's extremely important to give students the possibility to come to Germany or to come to Western Europe and go to universities there, pick up some ideas, and go back to their countries. So we have a general policy of trying to get students to Germany.
Yes. Please.
My name is Dohi Fassin with the Democracy Coalition Project. There's been a serious lack of international leadership on the human rights situation in Iran over the past 15 months. The UN was raised as a very important forum in terms of addressing the situation. But the reality is over the last 15 months, there's been no serious action at the Human Rights Council or at the General Assembly. We've had the same resolution been adopted over the past 3 years, and human rights organizations have called for a special rapporteur or a special representative to deal with the human rights situation in Iran, to start documenting abuses in Iran, and this has not happened. And I'd be very curious to hear from the representatives of the U.S. government and German government as to why this has not happened, and how you plan to move forward in the future to ensure that the nuclear issue is not interfering with the human rights situation. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. It's, in fact, two questions. I can't really speak to the tactical decisions that were taken in the Human Rights Council, why we didn't pursue a special rapporteur, or whether we're going to pursue one this time. I think it's absolutely worthwhile to ensure that Iran's human rights abuses are documented. I think there are numerous mechanisms within the UN system to do that. I think certainly they could be pursued more energetically, and we intend to do that. I think to the extent that we are able to work, sort of create a sort of critical mass of world opinion, it'll be easier to do that. Second, I don't think the nuclear negotiations, such as they have been over the past year, have interfered in any way with anybody's concern for or focus on the human rights question.
Also, what you have to see on the special rapporteur question is that Iran has a standing invitation to all the special rapporteurs, but didn't let any special rapporteur come into the country for 5 years now. So I know that several special rapporteurs are trying to get into the country to look at their specific thematic issue, which would be a progress already, but so far, all we can do is call on the Iranian authorities to comply with their commitments. They have a standing invitation to the special rapporteur, so they should at least, and that would be a major step already, they should at least admit the ones that are requesting to visit the country and to have a report, to deliver a report on the situation in the country. That would be a first step, and then we can see about the country rapporteur. But it makes no sense to have a country rapporteur when not even the existing rapporteurs can visit the countries.
من یه توضیح میخوام بدم. به نظر من دولت ایران از یک مسئله داره کاملا سوء استفاده میکنه.
I would like to explain that the Iranian government is misusing a situation.
از نگرانی که نگرانی درستی هست دنیا از برنامه هسته‌ای ایران داره سوء استفاده میکنه برای تحت الشعاع قرار دادن نقض حقوق بشر در ایران.
They are taking advantage of the sensitivity of the world towards Iranian the Iranian nuclear program to also take into account the Iranian human rights situation.
من قبول دارم که دولت‌های بزرگ دنیا، دولت‌های مختلف اروپایی، آمریکایی و حتی در بعضی کشورهای غیر اروپایی آمریکایی موضوع حقوق بشر ایران رو بهش توجه کردن. اما این توجه به نظر من به هیچ وجه با میزان نقض حقوق بشر در ایران قابل مقایسه نیست.
I believe that Western governments, other governments have paid attention to the human rights situation in Iran, but it is not comparable to the amount of attention that is being given to the nuclear issue of the Iranian government.
7 ماه پیش من بر همین ساختمان بغلی شما در کارنگی گفتم دولت اگر فشارهای خارجی بر مسئله حقوق بشر ایران اضافه بشه مسئله هسته‌ای هم به خودی خود حل خواهد شد چون مردم ایران دولت دموکرات رو انتخاب خواهند کرد که دنبال بمب اتمی نخواهد رفت.
7 months ago at Carnegie Institution next door, I mentioned that if the issue of human rights is solved in Iran, then the issue of the nuclear program will also be solved, because if Iranian people are able to choose their true representative, then they are not people who would be following nuclear weapons.
Okay. Alex, if we go to the gentleman right to your left.
Thank you. Dwight Bashir with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. I want to just commend the Deputy Assistant Secretary Dibble for the announcement, the U.S. government's announcement last month on the human rights sanctions. My question has to do with this, though, and it's for the German commissioner. We appreciate that in identifying 8 individuals of the government who are responsible for violations post-elections. There are others who we've identified who we feel should be named and could be named for violations before the June elections. But obviously, imposing the travel bans and asset freezes on these individuals is important for the U.S. to take the lead. is the EU, the German government, the French government, and so on, will they follow suit, is my question really to you. And because it seems like on the human rights issue, if there are sanctions imposed on these individuals responsible, that would put a lot of attention on the human rights issues, keep it separate from the nuclear issue. And I would like to ask Mr. Vahedi if he could respond. How would that be perceived if there are sanctions by the EU for human rights violations of specific individuals like Mr. Mortazavi and others? Thank you.
Well, I will take this question back to Berlin. We will be looking at this question because generally I believe that it is the only way that we can have, especially in human rights question, that we have sanctions that make sense and that really hurt are sanctions that are targeted at human rights violators. So I will take back this question. I cannot answer it from the panel, but I will take it back and I will look at it, because that is a kind of sanction which I personally believe in, that we should use in different cases, not only in Iran. But what we just have done, and I believe that is something, although it's not immediately connected to the human rights issue, we have just increased the pressure, the sanction pressures. And so what you see is that, and that has been always criticized from the U.S., the German trade with Iran. You see the German trade going down. You see German major companies now retreating from Iran. Siemens has just done so. Other major companies are about to retreat from Iran. Small and medium enterprises are leaving Iran. So there is sanction pressure on Iran that Iranians are feeling and that Germany is driving.
من باور دارم که این تحریم هایی که اعمال شده به شدت مؤثره، به خصوص تحریم هایی که اخیراً بر 8 نفر اعمال شد مؤثره.
I believe that these recent sanctions, especially those on these 8 individuals, are highly effective.
اما این سوال وجود داره که هر کسی میدونه در ایران که آقای مرتضوی بدون حمایت آقای احمدی نژاد هیچ شخصیتی در ایران نداره و آقای جعفری فرمانده کل سپاه بدون حمایت آقای خامنه‌ای کاری نمیتونه انجام بده.
But everybody in Iran knows that Mr. Mortazavi can do nothing without the support of Mr. Ahmadinejad, and Mr. Jafari, who is head of the IRGC, cannot do anything without the support of the Supreme Leader.
سوال ما این هستش که چرا سطح تحریم ها به در واقع فرماندهان اصلی که آقای احمدی نژاد و آقای خامنه‌ای حسن متوجه نمیشه.
And our question is, why don't the sanctions include the main leaders of the crimes that are being committed, namely Mr. Ahmadinejad and Mr. Khamenei himself?
Let's go right down here.
Thank you so much for all the remarks. I'd actually like to pursue this issue of sanctions further and ask Mr. Vahedi about the fact. I think, if I recall, a few days ago, a former advisor of Mr. Mousavi mentioned that he doesn't support, and I think by implication he meant the Mr. Mousavi's camp do not support the sanctions. Now, I'm not sure. I want to hear clarification on it. Did you just said that you would support the current sanctions that are mainly financial and others, and from most of the accounts are hurting the common people, and if that's the case, how would you reconcile your view with Mr. Mousavi's advisor? And contingent on your answer, if that's the positive answer that you do support, I would like to ask Mr. Dibol, how would you react if Mr. Vahedi, or if in that case Mr. Mousavi's advisor doesn't support those sanctions, how would you reconcile U.S. policy, which is basically lately at least pushing the sanctions more than the negotiation track? Thank you.
من صراحتا نظر خودم رو گفتم که من از بعضی از تحریم ها حمایت میکنم، دلیل هم دارم. ممکنه تحریم ها، یعنی ممکن که نه، حتما تحریم ها میتونه سختی هایی بر مردم ایران تحمیل بکنه.
I clearly stated that I support a number of the sanctions, some of the sanctions, and I have reasons. Of course, it is naturally, it's well known that economic sanctions damage the people of Iran.
به نظر من تحریم ها اگر به صورت هوشمندانه و جدی بدون تعارفات سیاسی اعمال بشه میتونه دولت ایران رو یا به تسلیم وادار کنه یا به سقوطش منجر بشه.
I believe that if the sanctions are carried out well thought, intelligently, and if they target specific parts of the Iranian government clearly without any political political without a political
تسلیم یا سقوط تا.
It can result in, I'm sorry, it can result in the overfall or at least the giving up of the Iranian government.
این که من میگم تسلیم بشن همون که دوستمون آقای لانینگ اشاره کردن تسلیم در برابر قانون قوانین خود ایران لازم نیست در مورد قوانین بین المللی تسلیم بشن. الان قوانین خود ایران به شدت داره زیر پا گذاشته میشه و نقض میشه.
When I say that it can force the Iranian government to give up, what I mean is that the Iranian government can give up opposing their own laws and to finally abide by the laws of Iran itself, which are currently being violated.
اما کسانی که نگران تخریب تحریم‌ها برای مردم ایران هستن باید توجه داشته باشند که ادامه کار این دولت بیشتر برای مردم ایران ضرر داره.
Those who are worried about the damage of sanctions on the people of Iran should understand that the continuation of this government damages the people more.
من فقط یک نمونه میگم. ببینید تحریم بنزین ایران اخیراً تصویب شده و هنوز هم عملیاتی نشده. اما 4 سال بنزین در ایران سهمیه بندیه که نشون میده دولت کفایت لازم برای مدیریت کشور رو نداره.
One example is that sanctions on petroleum are recently being mentioned and they have not even been put into action. But the Iranian government has been rationing fuel for 4 years. This shows that the Iranian government does not have the capacity to run the country in a well manner.
Let's be precise about what we're talking about. The sanctions, the economic sanctions that have been implemented through the UN Security Council and which we have followed up on and the EU have followed up on, are aimed specifically at sharpening the choices for the Iranian leadership with respect to the nuclear question. They have been complemented by, in our case and in other cases, a willingness on the part of the administration, from the president on down, to reach out to the Iranian leadership and to engage with them on this question as well as others. If there has been no progress on that, it's not because we haven't tried. The offer is there. The offer has been repeated several times. We are waiting now for the Iranian leadership to recognize the choices in front of it and to make the appropriate one, the one that is most, I think, most beneficial for Iran's future and for the people of Iran. There is some sign now that may be happening. We've seen this before, and I hope this time it's true that there will be a meeting with the P5+1 and the Iranian negotiators. I don't know for sure. There is no confirmation, but this is I think a very hopeful sign, and maybe we can get to where we need to be, which is an appropriate solution to the nuclear question and an end to the sanctions regime. That's what we're after.
Okay, time is starting to draw down, and of course the number of questions is continuing to multiply. So I'm going to ask, do we do two things? First, I'm going to ask your questioners to please keep your questions brief. And second, I think we're going to start grouping questions in the hope of getting more people in. So we'll start back there with Matt. Alex, to your right. There you go. And then we'll take these three gentlemen right here.
Hi, thank you. Mr. Vahedi, there's been quite a bit of talk here in the United States about the importance of keeping military action against Iran on the table, talking about the possibility of U.S. military action. Could you talk about what effect does this have on the democracy movement in Iran? Is there any measurable effect, good or bad?
Please, sir.
Yes. This is a question also for Mr. Vahedi, but also Ms. Abdo. Is the opposition, such as it is, gestating, or is it only latent? In other words, is it organizing, or is it just there? And secondly, do the people of Iran even hear of our human rights criticisms, given the control they have of the media?
Question regarding minority communities within Iran. You didn't address the situation. Since the revolution in 79, there had been a deterioration, especially the Baha'is, the Jews, and other communities. What is the current situation, and has it become worse since the 2009 election?
Mr. Dibble, you mentioned the democracy program funded at $40 million from FY 2010 and indicated this is the sixth year it's been in operation. But I'm wondering how this administration would try to differentiate the funding coming from this program, given it's been cast previously as a regime change fund, and whether sensitivities understood about not naming people, but how effective you can be if, in fact, groups receiving funds are not, you know, organically connected to civil society in Iran.
Okay, why don't we take some answers to those? So we can just go right down the row. We'll start with Genevieve, if you'd like to give some answers to.
So the gentleman's question about is the opposition there? I think that particularly after 2009, we have to sort of change the terminology. I would say that what exists is a social movement, not a green movement, not even necessarily an opposition movement, but what we're seeing that is evolving is different sectors of society that are now expressing grievances, from labor unions to women's groups to, and yes, they're not organized, it's not a coherent movement, but I think that what has fundamentally changed is that there's an apparent social movement in Iran that is much more clearly defined now than it was before the summer of 2009.
Let me address the question on the democracy program. I'm sorry if I was not clear. It is our interest, of course, in that our participants in the program be able to reach back into Iran. We're not especially interested in organizing the diaspora, particularly, except to the extent that it can have an impact back home. So the constraints that we're operating under require us to hold the training or the similar kinds of programs outside Iran for people who can travel back and forth or who can link in by other means like the Internet or something like that. But our intent is that the benefits of that program be transferred in. I hope that answers the question.
من در مورد وضعیت جنبش سبز اجازه بدید یک توضیح مختصر بدم.
Let me explain a little bit about the green movement.
یا بهتر بگم در وضعیت کل مخالفین در ایران نه فقط جنبش سبز.
Or in a more general manner the situation of opposition in Iran.
من گمان میکنم اگر یکی از اقداماتی که دولت ایران در مورد مخالفین خودش انجام داده در اینجا در واشنگتن انجام میشد تا مدت ها مردم واشنگتن اصلا از خونه هاشون بیرون نمیومدن نه اینکه تظاهرات نکنن.
I believe that even if one of the things that the Iranian government did to the opposition, not all of the things, if one of the things that happened to the people of Iran happened to right here in Washington, people would stay at home and not come out for a long time.
شدت خشونت و سرکوب در ایران به حدی بوده که به طور طبیعی میتونه حرکت علنی مردم رو تحت تاثیر قرار بده.
The extent of violence was so severe that it had an impact on the everyday, even an impact on the everyday livelihood of the people.
اما اگر جنبش سبز مرده بود به قول بعضی از متاسفانه دولت‌های خارجی و به قول حکومت ایران
But if the green movement had died, as has been unfortunately stated by some governments and also by is trying to be projected by the government of Iran,
دولت ایران مجبور نبود انقدر به شدت جلوگیری کنه از هر گونه فعالیت سران جنبش سبز.
The Iranian government had no, there was no reason for it to put such pressure and to prevent the leaders of the green movement from any action.
در یک سال گذشته آقای کروبی و آقای موسوی بارها تقاضا کردن، گفتن اگر دولت اینقدر به پشتوانه مردمی خودش اعتماد داره، فقط مجوز یک راهپیمایی به ما بده.
It has been mentioned many times in the last during the last year by both Mr. Karubi and Mr. Musavi that if the government has the public support that it claims to have, they should allow us to hold one rally and issue the necessary licenses for it.
اما در مورد حمله نظامی که اون دوستمون سوال کردم من یک توضیح بدم.
But also regarding military attack, which was also another question.
من گمان نمی‌کنم اصلا بحث حمله نظامی جدی وجود داشته باشه.
It is my opinion that the issue of a military attack is not serious.
طبیعیه وقتی رئیس یک دولتی مورد سوال قرار میگیره میگه همه انتخاب‌ها روی میز من هست.
It is natural for a head of a government to say that all options are on the table when asked question about it.
اما طبیعیه که من به عنوان یک ایرانی نمیتونم از موضوع حمله نظامی به کشورم توسط هر کسی باشه خوشحال باشم یا حتی در موردش فکر بکنم.
Naturally as an Iranian it's out of the picture for me to support or be happy regarding a military attack on my country by any person, individual or others.
نمونهش عراق هست که به هر حال شاید حمله اولیه به عراق بر مبنای یک تصمیم درست یا حال من کاری ندارم بوده، اما بنا به اعتراف رسانه‌های خود آمریکایی مقامات خود آمریکایی هزاران بیگناه کشته شدن و این میتونه برای ایران هم اتفاق بیفته.
A good example we have is Iraq in which good or bad the reasons behind it being good or bad thousands of Iraqi civilians have been killed based upon the reports by American officials themselves and this can be repeated in Iran.
من تصور میکنم اگر فشارهای اقتصادی و فشارهای سیاسی هوشمندانه بر دولت ایران اعمال بشه به هیچ وجه نیازی به حمله نظامی نخواهد بود.
I believe if intelligent political and also economic pressure is put upon the Iranian government there will be no need for military attacks.
اما سوال دومشون که آیا مردم ایران از فعالیت‌های حقوق بشری جهانی در مورد ایران مطلع هستند یا نه؟ بله مطلع هستند.
Your question regarding if the people of Iran know about the human rights actions that are being taken outside of Iran, yes, they are well aware of it.
و اتفاقا همین موضوع هست که آقای احمدی نژاد تلاش میکنه به مردم ایران ثابت بکنه کشورهای خارجی پشتیبان اون هستن.
And it is actually used by Mr. Ahmadinejad to prove to the people that it is the foreign governments that are the main supporter of opposition in Iran.
بعد از سفر اخیر آقای احمدی نژاد به نیویورک،
after Mr. Ahmadinejad's recent trip to New York,
ایشون در بعضی گزارش‌هایی که به مردم داد اعلام کرد بسیار از مقامات آمریکایی از جمله به دروغ ایشون گفت وزیر دادگستری سابق آمریکا با من ملاقات کردن.
He lied and stated that many American state officials met him during his trip in Iran when he went to Iran and he lied and stated that the deputy head of justice also met him.
البته آقای رمزی کرار با ایشون ملاقات کرد، اما آقای رمزی کرار که به عنوان وکیل مدافع صدام با آقای احمدنژاد ملاقات کرد، نه به عنوان وزیر دادگستری 40 سال پیش آمریکا.
Of course as far as I know there was such a meeting that took place but it was not in capacity of the deputy head of justice from 40 years ago but he approached him as a lawyer for as a de facto lawyer for Saddam.
Okay, let's see if we can just squeeze in a couple more questions here and get some quick responses. The gentleman over here.
Yes, my name is Shahyar Etminani. I'm from Iran Democratic Union. Mr. Dibble, you mentioned that you know, we all know that the vast majority of the pressure put on the Iranian regime, the sanctions and other pressure, is based on the nuclear issue. And President Obama has stated many times, you know, it's a way for the Iranian regime to change the calculus of the cost-benefit. Does that mean that if the Iranian regime backs down on the nuclear issue, all pressure will be put off? So their involvement in Iraq, their involvement in with Hezbollah, with Hamas, and in this particular case, their human rights violations will be forgiven and ignored once they give up their nuclear ambitions and comply by the West standards.
Okay, and we can go to, there's a lady just to your left, Alex.
Shahla Saligi from Voice of America, Persian News Network. We recently heard about the encouraging the regime in Iran to comply with their own constitution or Islamic law. Isn't it going to be turned to another slippery slope, perhaps giving them an excuse to haggle over that, whether they are doing it, you know, based on their own law or not? Or is it another strategy, perhaps, that, you know, maybe encouraging them for now and then next step?
Thank you. And then the gentleman on the windowsill, and we'll have to wrap it there, I'm afraid.
Hi, my name is Adi Ghadib, and I'm with Interpress News Service. And I have a question for Ms. Abdo, and then a follow-up for Mr. Loning. I'm just wondering if I haven't had a chance to read the report, unfortunately, but Ms. Abdo, you said that the a human rights discussion could turn Iranian public opinion against the regime, and I'm wondering if that's an endorsement of regime change, or are we just talking about Ahmadinejad or Khamenei, and what, just a clarification on that. And if the human rights dialogue is conflated with the nuclear issue in Iran, or as it's perceived in Iran, I'm wondering from Mr. Loning how the two can be separated, if you could expand on how to separate the two negotiations. Thanks very much.
Great trio of questions to end on. If I could ask for a brief wrap-up comments and responses to those questions from the panelists. Mr. Vahidi, why don't we start with you, and we'll go work our way back this way.
ببینید سوالی که فکر کنم مربوط به من شد این بحث تاکید بر قانون اساسی و قوانین ایران بود. هم آقای لانین که اشاره کردن و هم من، بحث این بود که دولت ایران فقط قوانین بین‌المللی رو نقض نمی‌کنه، حتی قوانینی که مدعی هستن رو به خودشون هست نقض می‌کنن، و اگر بسیار از اون قوانین اجرا بشه حداقل سطح نقض حقوق بشر در ایران میاد پایین. طبق قانون اساسی ایران انجام تظاهرات آزاده. طبق قانون اساسی ایران هر متهم رو فقط 24 ساعت میشه بازداشت موقت کرد.
I think the issue that concerns me was a question about the Iranian law and holding the Iranian government accountable based upon Iranian law, and by doing so to reduce the number of human rights violations in Iran. Based upon the Iranian constitution, public assembly is permitted and free. And somebody who is arrested can only be held for 24 hours before he is if there is no charges being held against him after 24 hours, he or she must be released.
Two questions on whether we would give up pressure if Iran gives up the nuclear gives in on the nuclear issue. Whether we can separate nuclear and human rights. I mean, this is, we always have a holistic approach to any kind of bilateral relation we have. What I was trying to say is, first of all, to give you an answer, I mean, why should we give up pressure on human rights if the Iranian regime gives in on the nuclear issue? I mean, there's no reason to do that, and there's also no reason to believe that, because we put pressure on other governments in human rights issues, so where we don't have a nuclear issue. So we do that with the Chinese, we do that with Russia, with many other governments. We have some issues with the U.S. in human rights question, and we address them. So although we don't have a nuclear issue with the U.S., so what I believe is that, of course, we do have a holistic approach towards Iran, which contains nuclear, it contains human rights, it also contains other questions. It contains the question of their role in the region, on issues on Afghanistan, we have more questions with the Iranians to deal with. But what I'm trying to say is that we should not forget the human rights question. And you were talking about someone was talking about missing leadership in human rights questions over the last 15 months. And that is what I was trying to say, is that we must address the human rights question, whether there's a nuclear issue or whether there's not a nuclear issue. And Iran is one of the worst human rights violators we have right now. And we have to address that very, very clearly, whether we have a nuclear issue or not. That was what I was trying to say.
I will simply say that I agree entirely that if the nuclear issue is resolved, if Iran meets its obligations, then the sanctions that are specifically linked to that will be lifted, yes. But as Mr. Learning has said, we have other issues with Iran, as we have other issues with other countries, including human rights, but not just human rights, and those will continue to be pursued, whether the nuclear issue is resolved or not.
Answer the gentleman's question in the back. There is enough research that's being conducted in Iran now. There's actually an American scholar at Johns Hopkins University who's done extensive research for a dissertation on how conservative, what we would sort of define as conservative public opinion, is shifting away from the hardliners within the regime, not just Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, but the way that the government has dealt with the demonstrations and with the post-election events that have occurred. And he's done a lot of research in conservative areas to show that public opinion can turn on the human rights issue. There are also scholars at Tehran University conducting similar research. So that's what I was referring to. And I think also, to sort of end our great discussion today on a more positive note, President Ahmadinejad is not going to be in power forever. And I think that we know from just sort of reading the tea leaves in Iran that Supreme Leader Khamenei is distancing himself from Ahmadinejad and that preparations are already underway for his successor that is likely to be a more moderate conservative that the West can deal with than Ahmadinejad, perhaps. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking our partner organizations, National Security Network and the Century Foundation. Read the report on the Century Foundation website, and please join me in thanking our superb panel.